It's 4:08 on WCCO. Today's 830. Coming up in just a few moments, we're going to be talking to John Farrell. John's with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And he thinks the direction we're going on this ethanol craze and wind farms, the rush to get it up and running big-time fashion, is inviting a lot of corporations to get involved, which may not be exactly the best way to do it. And he'll break down the figures that if you owned your own windmill as opposed to rent your land to a corporate wind farm, you'd be making a heck of a lot more money if you just did it yourself rather than have some become a tenant farmer, in essence, for wind. So we'll talk with him coming up in just a few moments on WCCO, today's 830. Now let's check WCCO's exclusive airborne traffic. It's 4:15. This is Don Shelby on WCCO. As you can expect from time to time on the 3 to 6 show, we're going to be talking about energy and energy future, about an energy efficient economy, the best way to go about that. Everybody has a different idea. Some people think it's a hydrogen future. Some people think it's an ethanol future. Some people think it's a cellulosic future. Some people think it's a wind future. Some people believe that it's coal gasification and coal to liquids. And there's a million different ways that people can approach this kind of thing. But right now it seems to have settled down primarily in the state of Minnesota between wind and ethanol. And the character of that commercially has begun to change, as one might expect in a capitalist society. And it's my pleasure to welcome to the microphone John Farrell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And it's good to have you with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on, Don.
I was fascinated by some of your writings on this subject. And I must say, having spent the last 5 years studying energy issues, I wasn't surprised to see that corporations, and if one looks at the Cirrus Investments and you look at Citigroup and you look at the big funds that have been set up now for energy programs, green programs, a lot of the capital money is going into these programs. People are really interested in getting on the bandwagon. Well, what that does is corporatize something that in the state of Minnesota, at least, began locally with farmers getting together and coming up with ideas like ethanol plants or building their own windmills. When corporations come in, that changes the picture dramatically, does it not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you said, in Minnesota, we started with, say, almost 80% of the ethanol plants in the state of Minnesota were owned locally by farmers, you know, getting together to own those plants. And as the, you know, larger investors, as Wall Street has taken an interest in this, the size and the scale of these project has really started to increase. You've gone from ethanol plants that just a few years ago were maybe 40 million gallons, and now the average size of one under construction is over 100 million gallons. They're really quite a lot larger. And the same thing's happening in the wind industry as well. The size and scale is really just increasing rapidly.
All right, so on one side, we hail Congress and we hail the state of Minnesota and the 27 other states that have set these high renewable energy standards to be met. But at the same time, we have to be careful, at least according to your analysis, that more is not necessarily better.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're trying to say is that most of the renewable energy goals, like you said, focus on quantity, but it's important to be a little bit more sophisticated about it. Let's say we've got, you know, like I said, the 100 million gallon ethanol plant, as is the average size these days. The farmers can't afford to get together and build a 100 million gallon ethanol plant. The financing is just out of reach. And whereas, you know, three small plants, maybe of 33 million gallons apiece, could be owned by farmers, produce the same amount as one really large plant, those farmers then would get over $9 million a year in dividends that would go right back into the community, whereas that one large plant is going to send all of that revenue, all of that money outside that local economy.
All right. Now, let's switch to wind for just a moment, because wind farms are becoming more and more obvious on the horizon, quite literally, as we drive across the state of Minnesota down into Iowa and throughout the Midwest, South Dakota, North Dakota as well. And corporations are getting involved in that. They're buying up a lot of farmland. They're buying up and then paying, as in essence, as tenants, a fee back to the farmer. Now, I hope you can recall from the top of your head some of the figures that you put together on that, but what would be the difference between renting out your land to a corporate wind farm or finding a way to build a windmill yourself? Tell me the differential to a farmer in terms of income should he try two different ways.
Sure. The differential is just, it's extraordinary, really. A farmer who decides to lease out his land to a large wind farm owner might get about $5,000 per turbine. And that's, you know, not a small sum, but to a farmer maybe isn't really going to boost his accounts all that much. On the other hand, if that farmer is an owner in that wind turbine, he can make as much as $100,000 a year by owning that turbine and selling the power to the power company and taking advantage of the various tax credits.
All right. And according to your research, there is something also beneficial about the smaller farmer-owned operations. The larger the megawatt production from these gigantic farms, the greater the likelihood that brand new infrastructure will have to be built, big, huge transmission lines at great cost to the ratepayer, great cost to the corporations behind them, a great cost to the taxpayer, and that's not even to mention the anger of condemned land and people getting upset. And in 1978, when I first came here, I was covering people who were sawing down these high tension lines because they just did not want them on their property for a number of different reasons. Among them, the fear that maybe the high tension lines were making them all sterile, as one group seemed to suggest. But when you stay local, you stay small. It doesn't require the construction of so much infrastructure. Am I right or wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely right. And in fact, there's been a study that was required by the legislature and done by Xcel Energy and found that as much as 1,400 megawatts of wind could be placed in west central Minnesota just using the existing transmission system if done in sort of a dispersed farmer-owned local fashion.
All right. Well, how much is it going to cost me if I'm a farmer to put up a windmill?
It depends a lot on how you go about it, but a lot of the ways that the farmers have gone about doing these wind projects is by partnering with what they call a large equity partner, like, say, John Deere, for example, is involved in some of these, where that equity partner comes in and provides a good deal of the capital to build the wind turbine up front, owns it for the first 10 years, gets the federal tax credits, and then after 10 years, the project flips to the farmer's ownership. In those situations, the farmer on a 2-megawatt turbine may only have to put in $25,000 or $30,000.
Really?
And they can still see the advantages because after that 10-year period, when the ownership flips to them, that's when they start seeing the really big returns on that, the $100,000 a year, even though they're also in the first 10 years getting usually a pretty good management fee from their equity partner.
Well, music to the ears of a lot of the farmers who've been listening to WCCO, The Good Neighbor, John. If you'll stick around, we'll talk further about this in a few moments, okay?
Okay.
John Farrell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance right here on WCCO. Today's 830. This is Don Shelby on WCCO, once again talking energy with John Farrell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance right here on WCCO. We've been talking about wind, and we've been talking about ethanol quite a little bit. And let me just ask you a question, and I don't want to blindside you on this, but it's the question on the mind of so many corn farmers who are listening right now, a lot of them in trouble with 30-plus counties considered disaster areas right now because corn crops simply won't come in. What does that do to ethanol production for the areas in which we find refineries in the state of Minnesota? And when things go bad like that, does that make them easy pickings for a corporate giant to come in and say, let me take the pressure off of you, son. I can, here's an amount of money, and you might not have had crop insurance out here, and I can come in here and take this off your hands for you. When bad times strike, as they will in the natural environment from time to time, as we've seen down in Winona County and Fillmore and Olmsted and Steele, are these locally owned co-ops ripe for the picking?
That's a really great question. I mean, I think there is a danger there in when you have sort of a localized disaster like we've had down in southern Minnesota, where the you know, the source for these ethanol plants, the corn that they're getting, is coming mostly from the local farmers. I mean, the advantage is that because corn is sort of a nationally traded commodity, that, you know, the ethanol plant will have an opportunity to buy corn. It may not be supplied by the folks in the cooperative if their crops are gone.
And don't we add in, though, because local self-reliance talks about having things 20, 30 miles away that you can rely on, whether it's food supplies or grain supplies or whatever. But if you start trucking things in from Nebraska and bringing in and big trucks and hauling all your grain in from someplace else, then you lose the local element of all of this, do you not?
You would to an extent, yes. And you also have that disadvantage of the transportation cost that you're
right.
going to be paying for that. And I think, you know...
And the CO2 as a result.
Absolutely. So there are some disadvantages there in terms of, you know, being at risk in a particular area. But at the same time, you know, we have a farm legislation at the national level that's intended to come and help farmers in times of disaster, and there's insurance policies to cover that kind of thing that can be taken out by farmers and by ethanol plants. And so there are ways for them to hedge their bets against that and to not be necessarily any more vulnerable than an ethanol plant owned by an absentee owner.
I know you know this, but Iowa became a net importer of corn this year. The number one corn-producing state in the United States became a net importer of corn because the price to feed the pigs and the cows on a bushel that they would buy off of the market that had already been set by ethanol production was too expensive to feed. They had to go out someplace where there wasn't an ethanol place locally and buy some cheaper corn to bring in and feed the pigs and the cows. Let me just ask you this way. Will this market settle down?
I guess it sort of depends on your definition of settle down. The one way to look at this in perspective is for most of the last farm bill over the past 5 years, farmers have struggled to get a price for their corn that actually exceeded the cost of production.
What would that be? What is the break? $3? $2.80?
Maybe between $2.50 and $3 a bushel.
Okay.
And so what we have with ethanol for the first time in, you know, maybe since the 1996 drought when prices went up last, have surged so much, you have an opportunity for corn farmers to actually sell their corn on the market and not depend on, you know, loans from the federal government or direct payments and that kind of thing for their income. And so it's one of the trade-offs, really, that if we want to have local self-reliance, if we want to have small family farms, we do want to be able to be paying them at least what it costs them to produce their product. And so with ethanol, we may be increasing production at an unsustainable rate right now, but I think it's going to level out and hopefully in a way that continues to get farmers what they need for the effort they have to put in to grow that corn.
So your mantra is very quickly, eschew corporatization, keep it local.
Yeah.
All right, John, thanks for being with us today.
You bet. Thank you very much.
And thanks so much for what the Institute on Local Self-Reliance has been doing here, not only in the state of Minnesota, but internationally as well. Thank you so much. It's about 30 minutes past the hour right now on WCCO, today's 830.